Good morning, everyone, and happy Father's Day, of course. We always want to acknowledge all the different holidays and everything, but you know what? Also, at the same time, we have to acknowledge that sometimes these holidays bring up all sorts of complex mix of feelings, you know, really. It's interesting, but in the last week leading up to Father's Day, some of the shares in the group meetings that we've been doing have all centered around the trepidation that people were anticipating Father's Day because of fractured relationships and dysfunction and all the things that are going on. And so at the same time that we celebrate fathers, and it's a happy thing, of course, it also we have to recognize that it brings up a lot of other things. You know, and then circumstances. Lisa is celebrating the first Father's Day without her dad ever, and I know that that's bringing up things. Scott is celebrating Father's Day without his son for the first time in 30 years. And so there's so many things that have gone on in our lives recently that change this complex mix of emotions. And, you know, even the bad things, I'm realizing more and more the older I get, it is that rich, complex mix of emotions, you know, painful, joyous, and everything in between that gives this life its meaning and purpose. Why would we ever want it any other way? Why would we want a monochromatic, a monotone existence? Because we're afraid, of course. We're afraid of the pain, of course. But if we can lean into that place and we can feel deeply all of the emotions as they come to us, take in and lean into all the circumstances as they come to us, see how even the most difficult of circumstances bring people together that may not have ever been so, and connect people in ways that we could never have imagined, open doors and take us in directions that wouldn't have been possible before. We start to get a sense of what kingdom life is all about. Start to get a sense of what Jesus meant when he talked about living this life right here and right now in such a way that our Father's presence was always there. And of course, you know, our relationship with our earthly father, whether biological or adoptive, is so indicative of the way we feel about our Father in heaven. And there doesn't seem to be any way of getting around that. It just kind of connects. You know why? I was asking myself this question. Why does it seem, for me too, my father was a great man. He was a great father, really strong, but kind of aloof. Kind of there, but always a separation. You know, we were always the kids, and he was always the dad. And darn if I didn't grow up feeling that way about my father in heaven. I'm here, and he's way out there someplace. You know how long it took me to start to understand that there was another way that I could imagine and experience my father's presence, Father in heaven's presence? But it's so human, I suppose. It's so indicative of who we are as human beings that we get imprinted early on with these relationships and they carry over. And for us in the Judeo-Christian tradition, of course, God is understood and described as Father, as masculine. And so that connects up with our understanding of fatherhood and the way we were raised. We talked about on Mother's Day the fact that the very names that the Hebrews gave, father and mother, describe the roles that they were supposed to play in their society, in the family unit, which was of absolutely overriding importance to a subsistence culture. The family unit, the strength of the family. And Ab, A, B, Aleph, Bet, in their alphabet, literally means a strong house. The father was understood as giving the rigidity to the tent. He was understood as the one who gave the sustenance and the provision and created the strong house. Whereas M, mother, Aleph, Mem, was strong water, which was understood as the glue that holds the family together. And so in father you have accomplishment. In father you have responsibility. In father you have performance. And in mother you have relationship. You have mercy and compassion. Mother is the one that will love you no matter what. Father is the one who's going to expect something of you. I've known three men, adult men, that were raised by fighter pilots. And each one had the same personality traits. You know, to try to live and to try to grow up as a young boy with a father who had attained that level, the personality of a fighter pilot in the first place, you know, to have that much discipline, to have that much sense of who they are and what their abilities were, was overbearing and overpowering, and these poor boys were pounded down. And yet some of them became overachievers and some became underachievers, but the same thing was there, that sense that they could never measure up. They could never attain their father's approval. And that damages us. But what we're after here, though, is a balance. You know? We need enough of moms, I'll love your face no matter what, you know, that unconditional love, that unconditional compassion. But if that's all we get, then we can never really move out. We can never really have what it takes to be able to be fully present in life, fully functional in life. And yet if we get too much of dad and that striving for some sort of performance standard, then we're going to be crushed. It's almost as if we need mom to provide this unconditional launching pad, the permission for us to go out and achieve the things that we need to achieve. We need mom to remove some of the risk that's involved with going out and failing and beating your head against the wall and getting beat up that happens out in life. But if we know we have that cushion, that pad, there's amazing things that we can do because we're not afraid anymore. There's one thing in the back of our pockets that we can count on. We got the ace in the hole. And if you've been here at all, you know that's exactly what Jesus' good news is about. Exactly knowing that our Father in heaven, as both Father and Mother, as the perfect balance between the two, gives us both. Gives us that love that we can't lose, that sense that we've got something that is giving us this floor, this foundation. And yet at the same time, is giving us law, instruction, guidance, the need to go out and perform to some sort of standard, to do things, to accomplish things. That balance. What Jesus did for us is amazing if you really think about it. His culture, his people, his religion referred to Father as Ab. And by Ab, they meant king, they meant warrior, they meant executioner and judge, they meant administrator. It was all those things that the king represented in their society. Ab, father, as king, represented those things. But at the same time, there was M. There was mother who represented the mercy and compassion that brought these things together. The moment that Jesus called his father Abba, it's hard to imagine the change that would have occurred in the minds of those first hearers. Because Abba is what the little children call their daddies, their papas. And Emma is what they call their mother's mommy. When he called Ab, the king of the universe, Abba, and was implying that level of intimacy, that level of connection, that level of being able to just crawl into daddy's lap, bury your head in his shoulder at those times where you really needed that, was the perfect balance of Ab and Em, the perfect balance of accomplishment and intimacy, the perfect balance of doing and being, the perfect balance of mother and father and male and female, and all those things he brought together in this one two-syllable word that locked people into the possibility that they might not have considered before, that it really was possible to have this relationship with their daddy in heaven. He wasn't off there someplace way up on this throne at the apex of a pyramid someplace, but he was right here and right now and present as he could possibly be. And so Jesus is showing us this. He's showing us this relationship that is possible. He's blending this awe and this intimacy. And he's saying, hey, you know what? It's not either or. You don't have to choose. It's both and at the same time. Our Father can do this. Our Father is Abun, that first word in the Lord's Prayer, which means this cosmic parent, this creator of everything. But at the same time, as extensive, as cosmic, as huge as he is, he still is someone whose lap we can crawl into, we can connect this way. And so the question for us on this Father's Day should be, how do we go from Ab to Abba in our own lives? How do we find this father that Jesus was talking about? This daddy, this intimacy, this connection, this level of knowing that we are loved in a way that we can't lose. Because if we don't make that journey from Ab to Abba, life is just going to be too scary to process, too scary to go out and do the things that we are being called to do. So, how did Jesus do it? How did he find his Father? How was he able to speak with such absolute authority, such absolute confidence about who his Father was? And to tell everyone exactly who he was in terms of that Father. Well, Jesus' principle was to seek first the kingdom. Jesus' principle was to seek first that experience, that quality of life, to live these principles that would take you more and more into an awareness of Father's presence right here and right now. Not there then someplace in the next life after we die, and not someplace way above in the firmament, way above in the rakia as they understood it, but right here, right now, right embedded in all of our moments, in all the details of our lives. This seeking kingdom, this living this way would take us there. And I wanted to talk about this morning what that looks like with some patriarchs, some fathers from the past. You know, what does it look like to make this journey from Ab to Abba, from king to confidant, to connected person in our lives? You know, the story of Jacob is really amazing if you think about it. What a story he's got. Jacob is the grandson of Abraham. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov in Hebrew. Sometimes the names just are so amazing if you listen to them. But Yaakov, Jacob, is this grandson. He's the son of Isaac. There's a wonderful story about Rebekah, who would be Rivka in Hebrew. When she was pregnant, after 20 years of trying, she's pregnant, and she's having a really bad pregnancy. She is sick, she's having all these problems, and someone prophesies over her, and they says, the reason is you've got twins, and they're fighting in the womb. There's two nations inside of you that are fighting, and she is told that this is going on. And when she gives birth to the twins, the first one to come out is Esau. And Esau comes out all hairy and red, and as he comes out, there's Yaakov holding on to his heel and pulling out. You know, he was second, but man, by a hair, because he was holding on. And Hebrew names are great because they tell us something about the character of the person. They tell us what's going on here. And Jacob, Yaakov, means heel catcher. Literally, it means heel catcher. It means supplanter. It can mean trickster. It can mean the one who is always conniving and moving and shaking and rolling and doing all these other things. And that's exactly the character of Jacob's life. Exactly what he was doing. Now, Esau, as the firstborn, was supposed to have the inheritance. But Esau was a hunter, and he was one of these guys that just lived at the surface level of life. Jacob was the more contemplative one. He was the one who was a tent dweller, and he stayed home, you know. And one day, Esau comes in starving after being all day out in the fields and hunting, and Jacob is making pottage, you know, just something there. And he's so hungry, he says, I got to have some of that. And he says, well, sell me your birthright. And Esau says, sure, you know, he just wants it. Wasn't really even thinking about it. But Jacob was serious, you know. And at the time that came for his father Isaac, who was now blind and infirm and aged, to give the blessing which allowed the firstborn to be able to take over. It was like signing over the trust to your son, but to give this blessing. Jacob pulls the trick, pulls the switcheroo, and goes in with the goat skins over his arms to hide the fact that he's smooth skin and not hairy, and puts on his brother's clothes so he smells right. And even so, the old man is not convinced until the very end, and he gets the blessing. He gets his son, his brother's blessing, who is then furious. And then because of that enmity, he flees out of Canaan, out of Canaan, up to Haran, which would be in either northern Syria or southern Turkey in present day. And he lives up there with his uncle, Laban. And there he marries Rachel. And then he has his own sons. And the whole story of his sons getting up to 12 sons. And when he finally has Joseph, the 11th son, he decides to come back to live with his parents again, to come back to Canaan. And as he's coming south along the Jordan, which would be to his west, he's crossing the tributaries. And when he gets to Yabok, one of the tributaries there, he is really close to Canaan, really close to his father and his brother's territory. So he sends out messengers because he knows this is going to be tough. Coming back to Esau after 20 years, right? But all this enmity between them. And he sends out emissaries, and he finds out, they come back to him and tell him, Esau's coming to meet you with 400 men. So he devises this plan where he takes 550 head of livestock of different types, cattle and sheep and goats, and sends them out in separate droves with space between them. And the idea is that every time that one of these groups of cattle come to Esau, he says, well, whose are these? And says, it's your brother Jacob, but they're a gift to you, and he is behind them. And so he's sending this tribute out to him. And then when all the livestock are forward, he sends all his family and all his possessions, and they ford the stream at the Yabbok, and he's left alone on the north side. And that takes us right up to where I want to read you this passage, what happens next. At Genesis 32, starting at verse 22. Now he, Jacob, arose that same night. This is after everything, all his family and all his possessions have crossed this tributary of the Jordan. He arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the foot of the Yabbok. And he took them and he sent them there across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. This man, this messenger, this angel, God, it's unknown at this time who he is, touches the socket of Jacob's thigh. And the socket of his thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. And then he said to Jacob, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall be no longer Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And then Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask me my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of his hip. One of those stories, right? What's going on here? It is so absolutely interesting to me. Jacob spent his entire life, and especially the last years, conniving, working, playing the odds, doing everything he needed to do to survive. He was wily and he was smart. 20 years before, as he fled Canaan to go to Haran, he had the vision that we typically call Jacob's ladder, right? And he saw this staircase or this ladder leading up to heaven, and the angels and the messengers and people moving up and down. And a voice from the top was giving him the same blessing that his father Yitzhak had given him when he stole the blessing from Esau, another promise. That was 20 years before this event. And yet that whole time, he was still moving and shaking and doing what he's doing. But he comes to this point. Everything is forward. He has been praying fervently to his God that he will not have a war with his brother, that he would probably lose. And alone, by himself, in that deep night, here comes this man, and he wrestles with him. And when his name is changed from Yaakov, heel planter, supplanter, heel catcher, supplanter, to Israel, which literally means, depending on who you ask, there's so many different ideas on this, one who strives or one who contends or one who struggles with God, one who prevails with God, one who sees God, one who rules as God or rules with God. It means all those things. And you can see why this name that was given to him is subsequently given to the nation of Israel, because they are the ones who contend with God. They are the ones who see God, who prevail, who rule with God, as they saw themselves as this chosen people who connected with God. His name is changed to reflect a change. But the scriptures are just the model of brevity. Look at this little piece right here. Jacob was left alone. The man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated. And then he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. You remember that scene where Mary goes to anoint the body of Jesus on Easter morning. And she is crying. And when she finally realizes Jesus, he says, "Don't cling. Don't cling to me." We aren't told that she runs to him and grabs his ankles and grabs his feet. You have to read between the lines here. But he tells her, "Don't cling to me," because that's exactly what she was doing. This is exactly what Jacob was doing. Wrestling, wearing himself out. Now he loses his leg. To the Jew, that was the pillar. That was the sustenance of a man's body. Without that, he couldn't stand. He couldn't stand straight. He couldn't stand upright. He is hanging on his opponent. He is clinging to him. And he says, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." Something changed at that moment. Something broke in Jacob that is represented by his hip. But what really represents is him finally coming to a place of dependence. Coming to a place of trust. You see, Jacob's life was characterized by mistrust. People who connive, people who supplant, people who are always playing the odds, who are always working and shaking and moving, are people who do not trust that the world is a safe place, who do not trust that the people around them have his or her best interests at heart, that they have to do these things in order to make sure they carve out a place for themselves. And as blessed as Jacob was, he still lived that life of mistrust. He still lived that conniving life until this moment something broke in him. Represented by the thigh, maybe, but something broke and now he's clinging, he's holding on. He made the transition from Ab to Abba to understand that that intimacy, that connection was really and truly there, that it was something that he could count on. And the interesting thing is that from this point forward in the book of Genesis, all the way to the end of Jacob's life, it's about evenly matched how many times he's called Jacob and how many times he's called Israel. What does that tell you? He's still Jacob, the supplanter, and now he's Israel, the one who sees God. Back and forth and back and forth. The struggle continues. He had a breakthrough. He had a moment where he finally became a dependent, and yet the rest of his life was characterized by a back and forth, relying on his own strength and his own will and his own power, and then coming back to rely on God. Back and forth. The struggle continues for the rest of his life. But more and more, he becomes characterized as Israel and not Yaakov. I love the fact that scriptures do not sugarcoat anybody. They just paint it the way it is. They let us see the deep humanity that is at work here. They let us see all of the failings. They let us see all of the character defects. And they let us see how difficult this is. Because the human experience is one that's based in fear until we know that there really is an Abba, that there really is an Emma who will take care of us, who loves us with such abandon that we have that launching pad from which we can go forward. And from there, let's take a look at Moses. Why not? Moses, Moshe. Moses' life is divided into three sets of 40. 40, that symbolic number that means a time of initiation or testing into a rebirth. The first 40 years as a prince of Egypt, where Moses is literally co-ruling, he's co-regent with the Pharaoh. Then 40 years in the backwater in Midian with Jethro, after he kills one of the guards because they were mistreating the Hebrew slaves once he realizes his true identity. But here's Moses acting on his own power, acting on his own influence, doing the things that he needs to do, exactly like Jacob. 40 years in the backwater with Jethro sort of mellows him out a bit. And there he is up in the high country, and he comes across the bush that is burning but is not consumed. Interesting, when Jacob asks the man his name, what he gets back is the typical question, "Why do you want to know my name?" The truth of the matter is, he was still looking for control, wasn't he? He wanted the name. He wanted the control. He wanted to be able to have something. And he wasn't ready for that. He didn't get the name. Moses asked the same thing of the voice that is coming to him from the burning bush. And he does get the name. Haye Asher Haye, which literally means, "I am that I am. I am who I am. I am because I am." You know, it can mean all of these things. But it's just talking about absolute self-existence. But Moses, arguing with the voice in the bush, who is telling him to go set his people free. "Send somebody else, Lord. you know, I'm not really good at this kind of thing. Still working, still trying to move and shake. And when he gets to Egypt, finally acquiesces, then he is exercising the authority there and moving and moving. The Exodus takes place. Now they're spending the third 40 years of Moses' life. He lived to 120 in the wilderness, in that place. And that takes us right up to Exodus 33:8, because Moses had learned more and more to be present with God, more and more to commune with God. At this point where this verse takes up, he had already been up to the mountaintop. He had already gotten the first two tablets of the law written in God's own hand. Comes down to find that his people had reverted to the idolatry of the past, had built the golden calf. He shatters the tablets and dresses them down. And when he goes back up to the mountain the second time, this is what takes place. But before he gets that final scene with God, we get a little glimpse as to the kind of relationship that he was building all of this time. At Exodus 33:8, it came about whenever Moses went out to the tent, and this was the tent of meeting that was constructed in place that before the temple was built. This tent held all of the sacred elements of Judaism. And Moses would go out to the tent, that the people would arise and stand, each at the entrance of his tent, and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent. And whenever Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent. And the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would arise and worship, each at the entrance of his tent. And thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. Wow. Moses had developed this daily walk with God. Moses had developed his presence. And yet, even though the scripture here is translated face to face, there's still something missing. It's not face to face as we would understand that term. Because when Moses is on top of the mountain, at Exodus verse 18, Moses said, "I pray you, show me your glory." He says this to God. He still hadn't seen his face. He knew that there was something deeper. As much as he had developed with God, there was something deeper. There was a threshold that he had not crossed. And God says to Moses, "I myself will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show compassion on whom I will show compassion." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live." And then the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock. And it will come about, while my glory is passing by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." I just think that this scene, this encounter with God, is one of the most beautiful in Scripture. Here is God answering a direct question in such a way as to show him as this loving parent. "I'm going to hide you in this cleft of the rock. I'm going to shelter you there. I'm going to put my hand over you so that nothing can hurt you." And here is Moses, the leader of his people, moving back into this place of utter dependence, this childlike acquiescence, this ability to just say, "Yes, God, I will do that." In other words, he moved from Ab to Abba. This is the moment when that takes place. And yet look at the rest of Moses' life. It is marked by anger and contention, back and forth and back and forth. And eventually, right at the eve of moving into the promised land, into Canaan again, you know, he hits the rock. He disobeys. He still is contending. He is still struggling. He is still wrestling, even to the end. Because that's who we are as people. It's what we do. Back and forth, back and forth. I think David captures this absolutely perfectly at Psalm 22. I want to read you just the first part of the psalm. Listen to this back and forth quality. It opens up, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus echoing that on the cross. "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night I have no rest. Yet you are holy, You who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel, in you our fathers trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were delivered. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. But I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. They wag the head, saying, commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him. Yet you are he who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust when upon my mother's breast. Upon you I was cast from birth. You have been my God from my mother's womb. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me, as a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, and it's melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws. And you lay me in the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. But you, O Lord, be not far off. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wild oxen, you answer me. Do you see the schizophrenia here? The back and forth. Does that describe our lives? Does that describe, as we move out in this faith walk, the back and forth nature, the dance that we do with God? You know, have you ever watched couples coming together and trying to form a relationship for the first time? One approaches, the other retreats, and then the other approaches, and the other one retreats, and it's back and forth and up and down and in and out, trying to see, can I really trust you? Can I really trust you? I'm going to risk something here, but I'm going to protect myself over here. And you watch this dance that we do with each other as we're trying to find relationship in the deepest, most intimate way. We do the same thing with God. God isn't doing that kind of dance with us. God is constant, but we are moving. And this is it. This is what it looks like. Without this wrestling with God that Jacob did, without spending that night going through that difficulty, he wouldn't have been able to break through to the realization that he really is loved, that he really can be this dependent. And just before the cross, just before Jesus goes to the cross, Philip is wrestling with God. Take a look at what Philip says. John 14, verse 8. Philip said to him, to Jesus, Lord, show us the Father, and it's enough for us. Jesus was telling them that he's going to leave. They're freaking out. Don't go, don't go. How could you go? You're supposed to be the one who's going to drive out the Romans. You're supposed to be the one that's establishing the kingdom. We're going to sit at your right hand and your left hand. How is this possible? You know? Well, then at least show us the Father, and that'll be enough. We'll be able to continue on. And Jesus says to him, have I been with you so long, and yet you have not come to know me, Philip? Wow. He who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own initiative, but the Father abiding in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. And the very last line, next line in this is that, if you believe in me, you can do these things that I do and greater things than these. Really? He wants to see the Father. He wants the reassurance. But Jesus is telling him, it's not possible. You can't see the Father. Moses, you can't see my face. Jacob, what's your name? I'm not telling. There are some things that we are not going to be able to see in this life. Now we see through the glass darkly. Then, face to face. See how this works? But here's the most important thing. It's not necessary to see the Father. It's okay. Because we have Jesus, who is one with the Father. And everything he does is as if the Father were standing right here in front of us. The very phrase he uses, the Son of God. In that culture, they understood exactly what that meant. When the Son represented the Father, it was as if the Father were standing right there. If the Son of the King came to you, it was as if the King were standing right in front of you. And you disobeyed any directive as if you were disobeying the King himself. Jesus is saying, I am here as the Father's Son in full authority. It is as if the Father were standing here. Everything you see me do, every essence, every character, every choice, every attitude is as if the Father were right here in front of you. You don't need to see the Father. I am one with the Father, and the Father is one with me. And what we start to realize is, as we move in, and Jesus says, you can do these things too. In other words, you can be one with me. You can be one with the Father. And we start to understand that this search for Father is really a search for ourselves. Who are we? Why are we here? How many of us can really answer that question beyond just the roles we play, the accomplishments that we have made, and the attributes that we display? How many of us can answer anything else? Maybe you'll say I'm a son of God. Maybe you'll say I'm a daughter of God. But what does that mean to you? And how does that characterize your life? Have you moved from Ab to Abba? Have you moved from a life of mistrust to trust, from fear to love? That's the question that Jesus is asking us. The search for Father is the search for ourselves, because any expression of identity that is not directly connected to ultimate reality, to who this Father is, this first cause that brought everything into existence, that sustains everything every moment, if our identity is not tied to that, to Him, Him who we came from and Him to which we will return, then what in the world could it possibly mean? Free-floating out there, disconnected. Jesus answered in terms of his identity the only way that he could. I and the Father are one. See me. See the Father. And in John 17, he says, now you go become one. He prays, Father, make them one as you and I are one. The search for Father is the search for our own identity. And when we wrestle with Father, when we get to the place where we can now call him Abba because we have become that intimate with him, and we have become broken in terms of our own quest for self-sufficiency, and we realize our true state of affairs is dependency, the true state of affairs is as a child with our Father, life begins again. What is the born-again experience that Jesus was talking about, except this realization that we were born again as this child who has this Abba, this Emma, this kind of relationship? This is what it's all about. We cannot go from Ab to Abba, from King to confidant, without that wrestling through the night. And we have to realize that even when we have the breakthrough, even we have the epiphany, the revelation of who we really are, that our life will still be characterized by the struggle. It's going to keep going back and forth because we're human. Because things happen that take our breath away. People die. Jobs get lost. Economies crash. Things happen. And then we wonder, my God, why have you forsaken me? Yet, here you are, and you've always been there for me, and we're back and forth and back and forth. I wanted to read one last little part of an article that was written three years ago, and it just has to do with Father's Day. But I think, once again, it expresses and epitomizes this sense that it is through experience. It's through just living life richly and fully and pushing into even the difficult moments, the painful moments that take us on this journey, that start to show us who our Father really is. And in that grounding, in that understanding, not understanding intellectually, but that knowing deeply and experientially who our Father is, that we start to understand who we are. He writes, what are we going to do on Father's Day? Burn some meat? Put on the new polo shirt, say thank you for the cologne you'll never wear. Yeah, somebody picked the day, but it doesn't really matter who picked it. If you're a dad, You know the exact date. It's the day your kids were born. The day your flesh came into the world to confront you. Yeah, let that one sink in for a while. You parents out there. The day your flesh came into the world to confront you. If you're not a dad, you can't understand it. Not really. Not before becoming a father. I thought it was possible to understand. But reason alone doesn't work. Perhaps it happened in a room of balloons and flowers, with grandparents and siblings all around, your wife smiling, tired, and the video cameras working. Or perhaps you were in the hospital chapel at night, bargaining against bad news. However it turned out for you, it was the day God bended and formed you like a link in a chain, connecting you to the generations behind you and the generations hopefully to come. It is the day men stop floating and become rooted in the earth, joined to it, knowing their place in it waits for them, because something of them will continue on. The baby's eyes are so big a few minutes after he arrives, so wide, and I was terribly frightened of the stare. I knew the twins couldn't really see me just then, that all they were processing was light and shadow and wonder, but it was frightening all the same. Their eyes demanded accountability. Now they're six-footers with chin beards, using that body wash that advertisers promise will attract all those gorgeous supermodels. They're good kids, but when they were little, people would tell me that they'd become teenagers someday, and it actually happened. Sometimes they tell their mother and me that we just don't understand things, we just don't understand what life is like, and we agree, and tell them to take out the garbage anyway, and wonder what they'll look like when they're fathers and don't understand what life is like either. Let's pray. Father, happy Father's Day. We recognize you as the Father of all of us, our Father. We recognize that you love us with an unquenchable love that we can't lose. And yet you still are looking for something from us, a willingness, a perseverance, a forward motion through the fears and through the things that are so difficult for us to find out who you are and who we really are, that perfect balance of love and performance. Thank you. Continue drawing us. Thank you for never letting us go. And we ask that you would show us through our own desire more and more who you are in our lives. Allow us to wrestle with you as long as it takes for us to get dislocated enough to be able to see who we really are in you. On this Father's Day, we honor all of our fathers, living and dead. We honor the fact that we can have these relationships that mirror who you are in our lives, that we can see something and hold on to something that is you, our unseen Father. Thank you, Lord. We love you because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.